Welcome to the third Thursdays at Many Rivers event of 2023. We seem to be on a monthly schedule, and before I introduce our speaker for the evening, I want to mention next month's event, which will be 4 weeks from today, I believe, on April 20th. Our speaker is sitting over here in the front row, Meg Levy from Stone Creek Zendo, and we will be very happy to have her tell us what she's doing at Stone Creek, and since she came along about a year ago,
right.
She informed me. So that's our next event. We're not doing the usual, or what was previously the usual weekly thing, because I'm getting old, and it's a lot of work to get all this together. But I'm glad to see the turnout today. Thank you all for coming. And I will be happy to introduce our speaker, but in introducing him, I want to talk about the book, really, because that's the occasion for this talk. And by way of doing that, I need to present a little background, and that is that I'm not a Tibetan practitioner. In fact, all the many years that I studied with my teacher, who's now deceased, long deceased, he was respectful of the Vajrayana tradition, and I never quite grasped why. Not that there was a reason to be disrespectful that I had any reason to credit or any experience that would support that view, but I just didn't get it. I simply didn't get what fragments of understanding could never coalesce for me. And I've been friends with our speaker for a number of years now, since he moved to Sonoma County or shortly thereafter. And this book was the key for me. So that's part of my introduction. But it's the key because it is an incredibly personal and as well as personable book. It has information, and it led me to grasp on a heart level why people would engage in Vajrayana practice. In fact, why people I deeply respect, other people than Ken, who I treasure, people I respect, have obviously gotten a lot out of Vajrayana practice. But this book allows me to understand why to a considerable extent. And moreover, the book is... Come on in. I think there's a chair over there. I don't know if you can get around that way, but maybe you can. Anyway, the magic of Vajrayana, I think of as actually not entirely unlike a work of art, as I have studied novels. I'm a science fiction fan for 63 years, I guess it would be, and I have long sought to understand how the arc of a story that can move me is shaped, or can be shaped. And this book has that, has those features. It's quite unusual. That's why in my descriptive email about this talk, I said it was unique. As far as I know, it is unique. And it is unique for those two reasons that I've just mentioned. And the personal aspect informs the whole of the enterprise of what Ken's trying to do with the book, or so I understand it to do. So that's in part my introduction to Ken. I have come to be aware that he has many, many books over here prior to this one. In fact, he has told me that Magic of Adriana is a part of a triptych of these two volumes. But there are others as well, and this is one of my favorites. But I've come to understand that the integrity of practice that is expressed in this book is actually also expressed in Ken's life. So that's the highest encomium I think I know. So
the table now.
What's that?
Can I crawl into the table?
Well, not yet. Demonstrated, baby. Anyway, welcome to this talk. Welcome, Ken, to this event at Many Rivers. We're being very selective now in our events, and so it pleases me to welcome you as well as all the audience. Now, Ken has said that he is happy to field questions. So, questions. The table is open to questions, but I'm going to get started with some questions, because I think I've already sufficiently embarrassed Ken that his no thought mind may already be engaged. So that's a test right there. But what I want to say about this book, in addition to what I've already said, is that it is really interesting to me, because in recent years I've begun to, in my own practice, to value ritual in a way that I formerly eschewed, having come up from 4 years of, 6 years of Catholic parochial school along that way, 4 years of being an altar boy in the Catholic tradition. And I had a lot of problems. I've since, in my reevaluation of ritual, come to understand that when I did get something remarkable from ritual, it has touched me throughout my life. The first powerful spiritual understanding came when I was about 3 or 4 years old in a Roman Catholic mass. So, but as I say, I put it aside. This book helps me understand why that was the, I guess I would have to say, life-changing event that it was, that it turned out to be, and how to use ritual even more extensively than I've been reintegrating into my life prior to reading the book. So why ritual, Ken? In this book, I'm not talking about why ritual generally. Why ritual in this book?
Okay. First things first, thank you very much, Robert. I have a notoriously soft voice, so if at any point you can't hear what I'm saying, please do something suitably frantic to get my attention, and I will seek to remedy it. Okay? That was a very humbling introduction.
By design.
Thank you. But I'm very happy to be here. I don't know. I've given a few talks here, haven't I?
Yeah.
And I think this is a treasure of a bookstore, and I'm very grateful to Stuart and you for putting it together and holding it together for all of these years. And I think it performs a wonderful service to the community, but it's also a rich resource for anybody who's seeking spiritually. And so you ask, why ritual? Well, I'm going to broaden your question a little bit, because in a quite definite sense, the two main themes in this book are prayer and ritual, which neither of which are particularly high on the category of practices that most people who regard themselves as meditators count. And the reasons behind that, or why that is the case, takes us a bit out of the scope today, but it would be a worthwhile discussion in its own right. When I started to write the book, I really didn't know how to write it, because there was no template that I knew of in the Tibetan tradition, or anything really in the Western tradition, for how this book turned out. So I was fumbling around in the dark, which is a place I find myself quite often. And one of the things that became very clear to me when I thought of the genre of practices that are known as practitioners of the Tibetan tradition as Guru Yoga, which I've chosen to translate as Teacher Union, in many respects, this genre of practices is regarded as the essence or the core of Vajrayana practice. And it consists in praying to one's teacher with a view to allowing your minds to merge or to join, whatever that means. And that's a very central practice. And in that practice, the principal activity which you're doing is you're performing a ritual, and one of the main constituents of that ritual is prayer. But in all the years that I studied, I didn't get a single bit of instruction in prayer. How do you pray? And I remember when I was translating for my own teacher, we were in Toronto and we visited one of the archbishops of the Catholic Church. And it was just a short visit, but the question that the archbishop wanted to ask my teacher was, how do you pray? And my general, within the Catholic Church, I've come to appreciate there's actually a very sophisticated understanding of prayer, but it is not widely or popularly known. And so much so that the way most of us think about prayer is what is called petitionary prayer. You're asking for something. That's basically some kind of transaction. And the prayer is judged, the effectiveness of prayer is judged frequently by, did you get what you're praying for? Which is actually a very immature way of approaching it. So the first thing I wanted to do was, because I developed through my own practice a relationship with prayer, which was very, very different. And then I found out all these other aspects of prayer afterwards. So that was one of the first things that I wanted to talk about, was prayer. And actually there's a section here that bears on this. This is, surprisingly enough, in the Teacher Union section. Treasured teacher, I pray to you. Give me energy to let belief in self fall away. Give me energy to see through life's illusions. Give me energy to let reactive thinking end. Give me energy to know mind has no beginning. Give me energy to let confusion resolve itself. Give me energy to know that life is empty presence. Now, that's a pretty high-level prayer, actually. You're not praying for health or long life or a car or a good relationship or anything like that. Everything expressed in this prayer could reasonably be regarded as falling under the mystical.
Under what?
The mystical. Give me the energy to know mind has no beginning. Well, that's not an ordinary kind of knowing. So that's a prayer that I met early on within my first year of practicing. And then I went on to write, this prayer has always spoken to me. I have said it literally hundreds of thousands of times. Even today, when I do teacher union practice, this is the prayer I say. And just as I have done for decades, I go to the edge of the world as I know it and reach out. That, for me, is the essence of prayer. To go to the edge of what I know and reach out to the unknown. I pray to my teacher, but what I'm reaching out to is more than a person. I'm reaching out to what I yearn to know or experience, what is exemplified in my teacher, mind nature, direct awareness, whatever you want to call it. In reaching out, I take a step towards that which is beyond what I know. So that, to me, is what prayer is about. It's a way of forming a relationship with what I currently don't know. And when you approach prayer that way, I think even as I'm talking about it right now, you can feel, if you're going to reach out to what you don't know, you have to let go of everything in here. T.S. Eliot talks about this in Four Quartets. To know what you don't know, you must go by the way of ignorance, of not knowing. And I think that is one of the reasons that people find prayer in our culture so very difficult, because we are steeped very, very deeply in a belief that we are actually in control of our lives. Now, I don't know how many of you still feel that way, but I learned the hard way. What does it say? Experience is the great, is the best teacher, but her bills are horrendous. That I wasn't in control of my life, and I actually did not start to relate to spiritual practice at all deeply until I started to let go of that idea that I control my life. Now, you ask about ritual, Rob. Well, ritual does the same thing. Tibetan Buddhism is built on ritual, and there's a lot of resonances with the Catholic Church. But unlike the Catholic Church, the Tibetan Buddhism in which I was trained, and I was very fortunate in this way, had not yet fragmented under its impact with modernism. My teacher did not know how to use a telephone, quite literally. I saw his nephew put a telephone, because there was an important Tibetan on the other end who wanted to speak to him, to my teacher, and he just held it in his hand and said, what do I do with this? And then his nephew jammed it against his ear and he went, so what do I do with this? He'd never heard of the Second World War before he left Tibet. He had heard rumors about the First World War. So this is coming from a very different culture with a very different history. And I feel extremely fortunate to have had that training. And ritual is part of practice. All of the deity practice, virtually all the forms of practice, are practiced in some form of ritual. has an opening, main section, and a closing. Some of the rituals are extremely complicated and multifaceted. Some are very simple. But ritual allows you to learn something in a different way. And this brings us to deity practice. How many of you know about deity practice? Yes. Meditation on death and impermanence led me to understand that everything I experience is transitory. But such understanding was largely conceptual. It didn't go deep. The understanding that came through deity practice was deeper. In the rituals of deity practice, you take birth as the deity. Before I even took birth as a deity, I had to die, albeit symbolically. Then I took birth as the deity in the ritual. I lived a life as the deity, and then I died as the deity. In each practice session, everything I was, everything I felt, and everything I thought I knew dissolved into nothing. And I took birth as the deity. At the end of each session, I died as the deity, and everything I am, everything I feel, and everything I know arose again, out of nothing. Day after day, month after month, year after year, I engaged that cycle. It changed how I saw life. I saw through, at least in part, the enchantments all of us live under. The illusory reality of sensory experience, of emotions, of transcendent experiences, and of control. Does that answer your question?
That's a pretty good answer. Not entirely comprehensive, but I'll take it.
What was missing?
Can I ask a question?
Of course.
Thank you. Marie.
Yes.
I was just wondering, as you were reading that, the question that came to me was, were you steeped in Mahamudra training while you were doing those practices? Because it feels like Mahamudra with symbols.
I think that reflects your own training. And deity practice is much misunderstood. Since you asked this question, let me go somewhere else. Yeah. So after the opening rituals of Refuge and Awakening Mind, which you're very familiar with, I'm sure, and there are a few other preliminaries that you do, virtually all deity practices start with one of two mantras. Now, a mantra, which you probably were going to ask me about anyway, so mm-hmm. I'll answer it now.
Good.
A mantra is a spell. It's a magic spell. That's what a mantra is. And one of them in Sanskrit is Om Shunyata Jnana Vajra Svabhava Atma Keham. Excuse my bad pronunciation of Sanskrit. But if you translate this, it's very simple. I am empty, timeless awareness. So just say those words to yourself right now. I am empty, timeless awareness. Now, whether you really know what the words mean or not, something usually happens. The mind stops. And it, within at most a couple of seconds, a thought arises. In my case, it was, where do I go from here? But something like that arises. But in that moment of mind stopping, a spell has been broken. An enchantment has been broken. And that's what the purpose of this spell is. It's to break an enchantment. And the enchantment is the one that we live under most of the time. It's the enchantment of experiencing the world and myself as a self here and the world in some way out there. That's an enchantment. And so at the beginning of every deity practice, you break that enchantment. And to the best of your ability, you let the whole experience of being the deity arise from that empty awareness. So in that sense, yes, it is fusion of Mahamudra, very definitely. And that is one of the functions, intentions of deity practice, is by performing these rituals, by going through this process over and over again, you are divesting the way you experience the world of any investment of self. That opens a lot of doors. And that's the purpose of the ritual.
Back to you. That was a beautiful answer. So, but I'm going to take you in a slightly different direction.
Is that comprehensible?
No, not comprehensible. Comprehensive. That's
yes,
the distinction.
No. Okay.
Which leads me to make the comment that the thing that's interesting about this book to me is that even though it's so steeped in a tradition that I have been unfamiliar with, there are so many things about it that touched me. As I reflect on my own practice over decades, very, very pointedly, very clearly. So, but one of the things I wanted to bring up, this is from a section which I found in many ways the most it's certainly one of the most affecting to me. It's called "A Way of Freedom," and it's a description of a 3-week retreat that you did in Colorado in 2003, and the point is there's only one meditation instruction or central one: do nothing. And then then you go on for many pages describing how, I don't know if wrestling is a fair metaphor, but I think it's pretty fair for a lot of what you write. How you wrestled with that instruction and what emerged from it, which it's something, it's not exactly as if I spent 3 weeks, but I have, my teacher would suggest something not unlike it, but I just never spent as much time as you did in this 3-week retreat, challenged by something like that instruction. So, but you write, there's another practice instruction that you report Ajahn Chah of the Thai forest tradition giving, which is put a chair in the middle of a room, sit in the chair, see who comes to visit. That's in the context of this retreat. And then you write afterwards, one has to be careful with such instructions in this day and age. Not everyone understands the poetry. So I want to, because you are, and this is a feature of Ken's work that I haven't mentioned yet. He is He aspires to be the most precise translator of spiritual ideas from, certainly from the Tibetan tradition, and aspires to precision in language in a way that I find unusual. And so, why is it that you have to write, not everyone understands the poetry? And how do you think, how is it possible to elicit an appreciation of poetry in this sort of instruction?
Basically, we have to turn the clock back about 125 years.
Okay, I can go there.
The end of the 19th century, a goodly number of artists had come to the realization that Western culture in general, English culture in particular, had largely lost its relationship with poetry. In that poetry no longer was part of most people's lives. And poetic thinking was really, by that point, the effects of the scientific and industrial revolutions had exerted enough influence that people could only think about things in material terms and in literal terms, because the scientific method proceeds literally. And this influenced religion very greatly, because unfortunately in Judaism, Protestant and Catholic Christianity, and even in Islam, one response to this, the power of literalism as exemplified by scientific method and so forth, was that the development of fundamentalism, where you took the Bible or the various scriptures literally. This is a modern phenomenon. It's not how things were done, you know, hundreds of years ago. And this represents another loss of relationship with poetry. Hmm. So that I taught a well-known text in my tradition, the Jewel Ornament of Liberation. Some of you are probably familiar with it. Over a 37-week course in Los Angeles. It's all up on my website if you're interested. But I realized partway through the course that what I was doing with the Jewel Ornament of Liberation was basically educating people that this is instruction, this is philosophy, this is poetry, this is culture. And helping people to distinguish, because most people had lost the ability to read a text and make those kinds of distinctions. They all took it the same way, and it led to a tremendous amount of confusion. So, with the instruction that you read from Ajahn Chah, and this woman put a chair in the middle of her living room, sat down in it, waited for somebody to come and visit, and then nobody came. She thought, oh, the meditation's not for me. I mean, this is what was related to me. I went, okay. And so here in what one would think was the most obvious metaphor was taken literally. And so I've seen so many people in studying the Tibetan tradition or in practicing the Tibetan tradition taking things that were intended literally, intended as metaphor or as mythos, it's mythic language, which doesn't mean to say they aren't true. I'll get to that in a minute. But they take them as being literally true. And this brings about disaster. A few months ago, I was in Armstrong Woods. A young Turkish couple had come to visit me. And we were standing in the open-air theater at Armstrong Woods. And while we were there, one of the docents came up on his bicycle and said and started chatting with us. And he said, "Do you want to know why the woods, Armstrong Woods, are so quiet?" I said, "Oh, no, that would be interesting. Why are they so quiet?" "Because they are very quiet." I said, "Well, what I was originally told," this is the docent speaking, "what I was originally told was that the humans," and this is the Native Americans, the indigenous people, "had angered the gods. So the gods had told all the animals to leave these woods. And that's why they're so quiet. But then I took my docent training and I learned the real reason for this. And apparently, redwood bark is very, very rich in tannin. Tannin is a natural insect repellent. So there are very, very few insects in Armstrong Woods. And thus there are very few birds and small rodents, the kinds that eat insects. And because they're not there, there are no larger animals. And that's why the woods are quiet. And I turned to my the Turkish couple, and I said, "Both explanations are equally valid." And so we hadn't concluded our chat with the docent, and then we went and had lunch. And over lunch, they said, "What did you mean, both explanations are equally valid?" The first thing to understand about explanations is that they don't explain anything. Why is the sky blue? Anybody?
Rayleigh light scattering.
That's the scientific explanation. But in Indian culture, the sky is blue because the face of Mount Meru is made of lapis lazuli, and the blue color of that rock is reflected in the ocean, which is transmitted to the sky. Now, does this help you understand why the sky is blue? Either of those explanations? No. Explanations actually don't explain anything. What they do do is they stop you asking questions. They deaden your life.
They give you something.
Pardon?
They give your mind something to eat.
Yeah, but it's pretty thin food, isn't it?
Well, somehow it's accepted.
Yeah, well, you feed a person stale bread all the time and they'll think porridge is absolutely delicious. Anyway, so people are always looking for explanations. Why this, why that, why that? And it's a way of not engaging the mystery that is right in their lives. And I don't want to present myself as any different from you, because I was so steeped in this, it took a lot to pry me away from that way of thinking and that way of approaching life. And it's not easy to let go of, which is another reason that ritual and repetition is very important, because you go through the stuff again and again, and it's like, you know, you're holding on to this thing for dear life, and you can't. Not if you want to open to the fullness of life in each moment. And so, how do you recover a relationship with poetry and poetic thinking and so forth, and mythic thinking? Well, the first place I would start is read poetry, old poetry. And in many respects, sometimes the older, the better. And learn how to read it. And I'm completely embarrassed at my inability, even now, to appreciate some of the founding myths in our culture. Christ going into the desert for 49 days. Well, did that actually happen? I don't know. But if you look at it as entering a period where he's going to deal with his internal demons, then it suddenly makes a lot more sense, doesn't it? You know, whether it was out in the desert, But it's about being with yourself in a very profound way where you have nothing to hold on to and you're trying to hold on to the sense of self. And that's a struggle. Yeah. And that's what Christ did in the desert. He struggled with that. In the same way that Buddha under the Bodhi tree sat and experienced all of the stuff until he could experience all of his internal material, his desire, as symbolized by Mara's three daughters, his anger, as symbolized by the rain of weapons that the demons... You know, how many of you felt like your anger is just like raining weapons on you? And he sat there until he could experience all of that as simply movement in mind. That is, he no longer had any investment of self in it. And when he put in that terminology, it's actually quite extraordinary that that's even possible. And then finally, Mara comes along and says, "What gives you the right to sit there?" Now, anybody asks you that question, you go, you become immediately become defensive. The self comes back up, right? Buddha didn't even bother answering. It was just another movement of mind. So, cultivate this way of experiencing the world, not in a naive, immature, or superstitious way, but as a way of expressing. The poetry is a way of expressing truths that are not amenable to ordinary literal language. That help?
Yes. Thank you. I should make sure that there's no, or create space for questions at this point. I can ask Laura.
Yes.
I really appreciated your bringing forth the magic of and the mysticism, the mythic qualities of, and in your experience with in these older Tibetans, it brings to mind meeting Tlingit elders in their 90s in Southeast Alaska, and walking in the woods with them in my 20s, and they literally. Their language was metaphor. That nothing else came out. Was that your experience of being with the Tibetans as well from that era?
Yes, and I didn't always appreciate it. In fact, I talk about this at one point, and I realized after the book was out, I missed an opportunity to make something explicit here. So I'm going to take the opportunity right now. In 1971, I met the 16th Karmapa at his monastery near Rumtek in Sikkim. A person of extraordinary presence, he alternated between joyous laughter and intense seriousness with bewildering speed. And I mean, he could go from one to the other like that. I mean, it's just, what happened? As he talked with our small group, he stopped and looked right at me, his gaze penetrating to the very core of my being. "Your faith in Kala Rinpoche must not change," he said, "whether you see him fly in the sky or kill a dog." Now, that is an example of mythic expression. He's not saying literally. What he's pointing to is where the faith has to come from. It doesn't come from reason or understanding. It comes from another place. It's something that doesn't change. It isn't dependent on circumstances. And I make a point of distinguishing between faith and belief here, which I see is very, very different. But that would be a typical way that things would be expressed. But I took that literally at the time, and it confused me. That's why I talked about, as I relate in the book, I talked about it with a friend many years later. But that's an example of the kind of thing that you're talking about. We have to be very careful here. We cannot go back. If we try to go back, we inevitably regress psychologically. And that becomes a real problem, because we become psychologically immature. And that's happened to an awful lot of people I know who've entered into the Tibetan tradition. Also at Zen, too, actually. What you can do is starting, I think it's best to start with people in our own culture, you know, and that's why I'm saying read poetry in our own culture, some of which will be more satisfying than others. And so you begin to get this feeling, and then you you nurture it. So you're moving forward and letting something grow in you rather than trying to go back to an age which has passed, which we cannot do. And I think that's very important. Yes?
I'd like to call attention to the celebration of questions as opposed to the answering of questions. When you celebrate a question, answers get a chance to like jump in and just take you by surprise. And it adds a dimension, what I would call a living dimension, to our conversational lives. And the way that conversation is introduced in this paradigm, it's it took me a very I never found it as a child. Never experienced true conversational dimension, depth, and I think there's a desperate wound there. In the way that conversation happens in this paradigm. Yeah. Never mind.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, where to start? So about 30 years ago, I had a Tibetan teacher. My wife and I were students of a Tibetan yogi, a Nyingma Lama, who was also a yogi, not a monk. And it made me crazy, and I crashed and burned as trying to practice that tradition, as I'm sure you've met a lot of people who have.
Including myself.
Yeah. You know, and I appreciate you bringing up the magical element of that, because our teacher had an incredible energetic presence, which is something in the Tibetan tradition that other Buddhist traditions don't seem to have quite as strongly. I mean, I'm sure there are teachers in the other traditions who do.
Yes.
Okay. I haven't met those teachers.
No, there's...
But, you know, the Tibetans do these really powerful practices that sort of cultivate that. And there are things that happened around my teacher I still just can't even begin to explain. And because of that, I know I tried to kind of swallow the whole Tibetan worldview whole. And it just, you know, made me crazy. I crashed and burned. If I knew then what I know now, I might be able to practice it. I'm sure you've heard that before. You can't go back. But, I would just like to say I had a little bit of a parallel journey, though in a different way. After I crashed and burned with Tibetan Buddhism, I had a year of desperate Zen practice. And then I met a teacher from like the Hindu non-dual tradition and had kind of an opening breakthrough experience with him. And it was weird and humiliating because it's like, okay, now what? And I found myself drawn to the ancient Eastern Christian tradition, where they have a very well-developed sense of internalized prayer. And I experienced very much what you said. You know, prayer decenters you. You know, it's not all about your mind and your feelings and all of that. It's all about being open to this, whatever this other is off the cliff that you can't grasp or contain or explain. And in some ways that really gave me a much healthier direction, kind of to deal with looking at. I'm very interspiritual in my orientation now because that allowed me to see the health in the healthy side of really all traditions. And I'm really appreciating what you're saying about Vajrayana and your own journey with that. So thank you.
Thank you.
So some of the things you were just saying in your last answer reminded me of something I consider to be a real feature of the book, but it also invited me to reflect on a different way to take what I'm about to say, which is that one of the features of the book is your personal honesty of the difficulties, and that of course reflects in Joseph's question and comment here, the difficulties along the way that you experienced. And there's we're in a moment, I think, when confessional expression is valued, but not necessarily, I would say, for the right reasons. And so I want to ask you to express what you think the right reasons are for the deeply honest reports of your engagement with the difficulties that you encountered along the way in your practice that had the effects it had.
I can't tell you what the right reasons are. I can only tell you what my intention was.
Got it.
My teacher was a master of his tradition. And one stage of his life, he lived in the mountains of eastern Tibet. And I remember his nephew describing one place that he lived, which was the north face of a high mountain with a very shallow cave. That winter had been so severe that everybody in the valleys had given my teacher up for dead. And when the snows were passable, a party, including his nephew, struggled up and found him very happily practicing in this very shallow cave facing the north. And the nephew described this as a horrible place, you know, to use an English expression, completely godforsaken. He said he couldn't imagine spending one night there, let alone the whole winter. And my teacher had lived there the whole winter on nothing but a, because nobody could get to him, a sack of roasted barley flour and some tea. That was the extent of his mastery of things like tumor, the ability to generate inner heat and whatever. And he told me himself personally on another occasion that he had been perfectly happy meditating in the mountains, which is what he really would have liked to have continued to do, but his own teacher had told him in the most irrefutable way that he had to come down and teach the 3-year retreat. So in writing this book, there is no way I could present myself as a Vajrayana master, because I'm not. I could only present myself as what I actually am, which is a student of this path. And that this book is fashioned out of my own experience and my own understanding, and that's all I can say. And the other piece is that any form of spiritual practice is dangerous, because you're meddling with some of the most basic instinctual drives that we have. We're conditioned to survive, very deeply conditioned. We're conditioned to socialize. We're conditioned to identify as something, biologically, genetically, not to mention psychologically, emotionally, culturally, socially, etc., etc., etc. And I wanted to make it clear to people that this is not a walk in the park. It may be for some people, that actually is a walk in the park, but it's not for everybody. And for most of the people I know, it hasn't been. And so I felt it would be helpful not to make general statements, but to give people concrete examples of what it was like for me. But I really didn't want it to be, what's the word you use, confessional?
Yes.
Yeah. I didn't want it to be a confessional, so I tried very hard to strike a balance in which I was, the book isn't really about me. I talk about my own experiences in order to illustrate some of the points I'm making about the teachings. And that's, you know, you will decide whether I hit that balance or not. I can't. But that's what I was aiming for.
Yeah, and I'll just comment that is decidedly the effect on me. And before we go to your question, I just want to mention that it's not just about Vajrayana or Vajrayana would-be practitioners. It's about practitioners in general, because I have a very different tradition in many respects, even though some of the things you were saying about Kala Rinpoche are definitely remind me of some of the stuff of my own teacher. But the point is that I don't want to say weaknesses, because that takes it back into the confessional. But challenges, we all have challenges, and I think you were right to present skillfully your engagement with challenges as a general principle in the grounded way that you did, because I think that can be helpful for people. So, your question.
So I haven't read any of your books, but so I don't know a lot about you, but did I understand you worked with Kalu Rinpoche, and did he give you transmission to teach? No, I'm just curious. I'm not trying to question your authority, okay?
Yes.
I'm just curious, because so many people make a big deal of that, you know, well, this, you know, master did this.
Yes, he did.
Because he kind of faded from the primary focus of, you know, the current teaching. I mean, you know, he didn't stand out as much, except maybe for people that were following him directly. That was a non sequitur, I'm sorry.
Okay, yeah.
Did he give you transmission?
He said yes.
Well, the reason I'm in California is because Kalu Rinpoche sent me here to teach.
I'm sorry, but...
Kalu Rinpoche sent me here to teach.
To teach, okay.
Yeah. That's why. That's the only reason I'm in California. Something might have led me here otherwise, but I don't know what it would have been.
Okay.
The beauty of Sonoma County.
Well, no, that came much later.
I know, I'm teasing.
He sent me to Los Angeles.
No, I came from a tradition where, you know, they did things like, you know, designate their next whatever regent or, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, and
so I didn't know if that worked.
Well...
I don't think it matters, maybe. I don't know.
What's really your question? There's another question in here. What is it?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, take a while and tell me. Yeah. Ask that one.
I think I'd be more leery and afraid of you if you were actually had some kind of scepter, you know. I did that one. Rejected it.
On your question?
Mm-hmm.
Or what are you trying to resolve here? No? Okay.
There's a question over here.
I had a question. You read from the book at the very beginning of this talk, the Guru Rinpoche prayer, and I had always heard it as "Bless me," you know, that I may realize confusion in your own ground. But you translated it as something like "Give me the energy."
Yeah.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you say more about that?
Yes, I can say a lot about this.
Great.
I think the word in Sanskrit is adhisthana. The word in Tibetan I'm more familiar with is chinlap. And like many Tibetan words, it's composed of two words, chin and lap. Chin is related, or the root meaning of chin is to give. And lap is the word for wave. So it's a wave of giving. Now, there are probably three ways to translate this into English. And I think any of them are valid. Give me energy is one, because there's that, something's being given, it's like a wave, so there's the energy there. And the problem with that translation is that it doesn't do the emotional quality justice. Another way, of course, is what you've heard is blessing. I have a difficult time translating anything as blessing, because the origin of the word blessing in English culture is blood was used to bless things and sacrifice. That's the actual origin, and I pay a lot of attention to the original etymology. And it works somewhat in Christianity because it's Christ's blood, but that doesn't have any place in Buddhism. And the third one is probably the best, and that would be grace. But you'll run into a little resistance about that in certain circles. So take your choice. Okay?
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you.
I mean, grace would be perfectly fine. But then you'll see me drawn and quartered. And, you know, I'm having a good time in my life right now, so I'm not quite ready for it.
There was another question. Oh, go ahead.
I had a question about the protector stuff.
Oh, no.
The protector stuff. Are you talking about in my book or the protector stuff, period?
Protector practice, the genre.
Yes, okay, fire away.
It's, I know, like, you presented it quite openly, and it's other traditions, Nyingma teacher in particular, had a very a view that that could be like he wouldn't give that to hardly anybody because he felt it was dangerous. I think he had a more shamanic view that those are entities that can, you know, you can really you state that in your text as well. You don't say that this is a lightweight practice, but I guess my impression through that teacher was this is dangerous magic, so don't do it unless I authorize it for you to do it. So, and he didn't do that. I only know one or two people who were doing that.
So what's your question? Or do you have one?
I don't know. It's just, could you reflect on why such a difference? Like, why is it so openly taught in some places and so reserved in others? It's just...
I didn't say it was openly taught.
It's more than openly written about, I guess.
Well, basically your question is, how did I dare do that?
Okay, yeah. How did you dare do that?
Thank you!
No, obviously, no. It's
so that's the question you're actually asking.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't have either view.
No, you absolutely you do. I'm sorry.
Well,
you say this teacher did this, and you did this.
Yeah. No, I don't. I don't have a view that isn't going to be good for some people in some circumstances. But yeah. I don't. I never really understood the whole protector thing. It just feels like Western magic, or yeah.
In Japanese Shingon, there's no distinction between yidams and protectors. I think this may be a later development in Indian Buddhism. And I don't know to what extent it was shaped by Tibetan culture, because I think there's an element of it there, which had its own very rich shamanic tradition. The question isn't really how did they do it, and and we should just do it that, and we should just do what they did. That's been tried a lot of different ways, and it hasn't worked very well. And when I first came to Los Angeles, I took as my motto, so to speak, I won't do what I know doesn't work. I'm not sure what I will do, but I won't do what I know doesn't. And there's a long list of things I knew didn't work by that point. So, a friend of mine strongly encouraged me to not be inhibited by what was regarded as secret in the Tibetan tradition. This is a person who has practiced in the Tibetan tradition as long as I have, and her own principal teacher just said sometime in the early 2000s, oh, there's no point in keeping any secrets. You can find anything you want on the internet. which is even more true now than it was then. So I made the decision for two reasons. There's very little talked about or written about the protectors in the Tibetan tradition itself.
Yeah.
You get the basic commentaries on commentaries. You get the basic elaboration of instructions on the meditations. There's very, very little explanation, not the kind of explanation you get for all of the other aspects. That probably has something to do with the shamanic roots and the roots in Tibetan shamanism. But I don't know that. That's conjecture. But I've seen so many problems arise because there isn't a full understanding. The kind of psychological regression that I was talking about earlier is just rampant, and people having a very, very immature relationship with this stuff, and that affecting their practice negatively in quite serious ways. And actually, in many cases, very difficult to pry people out of for all kinds of reasons. But there's a huge investment of self in the way that they're approaching it. They think it is the right way. And then there's the people who just take it, fascinated by it, but it's with a view of controlling their lives. Now that's not helpful from a spiritual purpose. So I decided, what the hell? I'm just going to put it out as I understand it, in the hope that it connects with a few people the right way, because it's not going to do any more harm than is already being done.
True that.
So there you are.
You may have just answered my question, but I was curious. You write, do you have any students now, or are you retired? Or?
Yes.
Yes, you're retired, or yes, you have students.
I have students,
yeah.
But I'm retired.
Yeah.
And I'm, yeah. So, yes.
So the whole list of things that didn't work, was that because of the cultural context of these teachings in current American culture, Western culture?
All kinds of things. You know, I mean, we know Dharma centers don't work for all kinds of reasons. We know Asian authoritarian structures don't work for all kinds of reasons. How many centers have gone under because they tried to buy property too soon? All kinds of reasons. Hmm. That has nothing to do with Tibetan culture particularly. That's just tried. I mean, people tried different things. Residential centers, very, very difficult. Usually don't work, only for a period of time. And it's just one thing after another.
There's a question over here.
I haven't read this last book, but I have read the other books. And I don't know if it's addressed in this book, but I'm working more now with nature's mind practices.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder, you know, and the more you work with that, in my experience, you feel more, you know, you feel more and more permeable.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you can say anything about the paradox of the say I am timeless, empty timeless awareness and the body. So if how integration or not, or, you know, like, and if, you know, I'm thinking of Kalu Rinpoche, who seemed to be so, you know, tiny and penetrable and permeable, and as opposed to Bilgo Kensei Rinpoche, who was such a, you know, grounded, empty vessel. So I am just struggling for myself with that paradox, kind of, the body waking down or waking up.
So, when you say, I am empty, timeless awareness, what happens in your body?
Well, what I experience is a stillness, a shakiness, like the body becomes more like bubbles, energy, rather than density.
Can you rest there? There you are.
I'm thinking we should probably conclude soon, unless you are... You have even more energy than I give you credit for.
I'm going to digest that one. Any final question? Yes.
You started out talking about guru devotion and then also the dangers of a kind of regression, taking it too seriously, maybe in serious is light word, and maybe especially in a Western context. So what are the dangers of the proper way of relating to a teacher holding those two elements?
This is a very important question. In our culture, there are many forces, all too many forces, which encourage us to, and in some cases even limit us in developing emotional maturity. This, with respect to many of the Asian traditions, plays straight into the family model that is present. You regard your teacher as a parent, a spiritual parent, granted, but that often just plays straight into the emotional immaturity on the part of Western students, and that is a real problem. And so people relate to their teacher as a child would. Most teachers aren't interested in that, actually. They are much more interested in dealing with, working with someone they can actually have a conversation with. But there's a lot of cultural stuff that gets in the way of that. On both sides. So, I think when you approach practice, and this is something I had to work with in myself, you have to be very, very clear. And I think part of the purpose of the practice is to help you become very clear about what your own values actually are. And they're going to be shaped in the course of practice. But without that internal checking in periodically. Problems can develop. And the other piece, another piece that plays into this is the literalism with which Westerners interpret things. And this is where, you know, in Japanese culture and in Tibetan culture, people move back and forth between mythic language and rational language very, very easily. We don't know how to do that anymore. We did in our history, but not since the late 19th century. Probably earlier than that, but definitely since then. We've completely lost that facility. And so people will take... And so educating and developing that some gesture in that direction, I think, is very, very important. Because being able to express and hear things mythically when it's appropriate, and being able to express and hear things, you know, that are important. I mean, what's the difference between mythos and rational and logos in this sense? Mythos is about what gives life meaning. Logos is about how you actually navigate life. And when you try to use mythos to navigate your life, it doesn't work out very well. And when you try to use logos to give life meaning, it doesn't work out very well.
Zeros.
Yeah, so, does that help?
That's very helpful, thank you.
Okay, right. All right.
All right, well, first of all, I want to thank you all for coming tonight and listening with attention. Because I see there was some of that here tonight. And I want to thank Ken for speaking with attention to that listening, because that's not, that is something to celebrate that we don't see often enough. And I will further mention that you see this table over there. We have a few of his books there, but there's a whole box down here. We've got plenty of books to buy, and I cannot, as I think I've made more than clear, recommend this book more highly, not just for the Vajrayana and would-be Vajrayana, but for other people interested in other traditions as well, or in spiritual. But by the way, there's a chapter at the end called Living Practice, I believe it's called, which has lots of good little tips.
And the price of the book.
It's such a deal.
So such thank a deal. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. What? Oh. And we have a donation bowl, or we will shortly have a donation bowl over on the counter there when you come over in that direction. And we encourage you to contribute to it, because we share our donations with our speakers and to maintain the store for future such events. Thank you. I had to be reminded. My husband's going...
I had to remind you last.
I know. I'm getting old.